Could you be harboring misguided beliefs about gardening? Maybe you've picked up some bad advice on social media. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our full hour of gardening, our experts are here to debunk some myths that might be doing your plants more harm than good. And of course, they'll answer your questions. Joining me now are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus. Welcome back, Sarah.
Good to be here.
Great to have you. Naturalist at the Crow Nose, Carol Mundy. Thanks for being here, Carol.
Glad to be back.
And Kenton County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Brandon George. Welcome back, Brandon.
Thanks, Lucy.
We know you have questions for them, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Now, we may not always know the best place to turn for gardening advice. Of course, I think this show is number one, but whatever. Sometimes people look online, see a tip on social media, or maybe get advice from a friend. I want to ask each of you, I'll start with you, Sarah, can you tell me what's the number one thing you hear from people that's just not exactly true? Something they said, oh, I'm doing this in my garden because I heard blah, blah, blah. And you just think, grant me patience, Lord. And then you explain it to them.
I think using home remedies, the biggest one I would say is using dish soap for an insecticide.
Dish soap. And so what do people usually do? Just like go out there and squirt Dawn on bugs?
Well, I think that there might be either they found, quote, a recipe online, or they just might have made it up, or they heard, oh, just put a little Dawn soap on it or whatever. And dish soap, I should say, not just a. And so what I've heard from both entomologists and pathologists, but particularly for this liquid home remedy for dish soap, is actually dish soap has fatty lipids in there to remove grease primarily, right? And so the cells of plant material that we're targeting, right? And they are super sensitive. So what ends up happening is a phototoxicity happens, which is an abiotic symptom. So it's because it's an environmental effect at that time, at that point. So meaning the dish soap that you're using is actually killing or showing symptoms of an issue because of what you sprayed. So it's those fatty tissue or those fatty acids, I guess, in the dish soap. Again, I am not a chemist, but that when the sunlight especially hits that, it can actually burn the cells of the plant tissue. So you're doing more damage than good. So dish soap by far is my number one, but just home remedies as a whole umbrella is by far both for pest management of insects, weeds, and diseases.
Mm. What about you, Carol? What do you hear that you just kind of try not to roll your eyes too
right.
big?
It is. Well, and they can't see us rolling our eyes on the
right.
radio. Vinegar comes up a lot, which, you know, and I've tried some of these things. Okay, there's that thing coming up between the crack and the sidewalk, so it's not going to kill anything else. I might try this to see. But the idea, this is an acid.
Vinegar is a weed killer, basically?
As a weed killer, sure. And again, it goes back to this is very acidic, and so you're causing damage to the cells, and if it gets on the wrong plant. But I'm with you. The whole idea of some of these home remedies, you really have to do your homework to make some sense. And yeah, you have to do the work. Don't just run out there because Aunt Jo's friend who lives next door, who's from, I don't know, Claremont County, says it worked for her. Do your homework. And you do have to understand a little bit of chemistry and botany to realize how it's going to affect that plant.
Yeah. What about you, Brandon?
Yeah, my one I get a lot, well, yeah, the most common would be the fact that pine needles acidify soil.
It's
just simply not true. I feel like what people forget is that what dictates the soil's pH is always the parent material, that the rock that forms what becomes soil, you know, sand, silt, clay. And so basically, you know, if you plant a pine tree on there, something that has pine needles, it's still going to have the same pH, and maybe the very surface of the soil is going to have a slightly lower pH as they decompose. But by and large, that soil is going to be exactly what the parent material is, which is around here, limestone shale. And so that is not a way to effectively drop your pH. You really need to actually change the soil chemistry. It's recommended you would use elemental sulfur or add peat moss or things that naturally would change your soil's texture and structure as well as drop the pH, which takes a long time. But really, pine needles are not going to do it. They can be great as mulch, but they will not acidify your soil and change the pH.
And you kind of have to, wouldn't you have to do a soil test to even know if you want to change your soil's
pH?
Right,
exactly. And I think what the confusion comes is people will see things, they'll see pine trees, and they'll be like, oh yeah, that's soil, it's making the soil more acidic. But what they don't realize is that plant is growing there because it's in the soil it wants to be. The reason why you associate pine trees with acidic soil is because they generally grow in places where the soil is more acidic.
Okay.
And so I think that's kind of maybe where some of the confusion comes up.
Makes sense to me. We have Jeannie on the line. Hi, Jeannie. Thanks for your call. What did you want to talk about?
Hi. I have a letter here. Oh, I'm sorry. I really love this show. I'm usually not off today, so I'm glad I could call in. I have a letter here from the Arbor Day Foundation, and they want to send me free trees. They say they're for the Cincinnati area, and I just want to make sure that they really are for the Cincinnati area, because I'm supposed to get 5 free flowering trees, 5 free fast-growing Norway spruce trees, and then 2 free flowering crepe myrtles, of course, if I make a donation. Is this really good for Cincinnati?
Oh, if you make a donation, there's the catch. Okay. Carol, it looks like you want to weigh in on this.
Nothing is free. There is no free lunch. Crepe myrtle, even though it's growing well in the Cincinnati area, it's not native to this area. Things obviously have changed, and crepe myrtles are doing well. It's surviving and flowering. And Norway spruce, we have had a lot of trouble with spruces. There has been quite a problem with a pathogen that are taking a number of other spruces down. And so I would probably pass on those 2 trees. I would be looking at something in the area that you're in. Go look at the list for the state of Ohio. We have Ohio Natural Areas and Preserves, and they actually have the list. Go to the Ohio Department of Forestry. And look at that. If you're in Northern Kentucky, do the same thing. The University of Kentucky, excellent resource right in your own back door. And it's free.
Yeah.
You can get that information and then start doing the shopping or the pledging.
Yeah. So the information is free, but maybe not. What do you think, Sarah? Don't take those free plants?
No. I mean, I don't mind a crepe myrtle, to be honest. In my space, Norway spruces are gorgeous. They're not native, they might do okay, but might.
Might, yeah.
Okay. Jeannie, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for listening and for calling. I'm glad you had the day off, too.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye. Bye-bye. We are on for a full hour of gardening today. We know you have questions for our experts, and we're busting myths. What have you heard or read online? Give us a call. We will fact check the claim that you've read at 513-419-7100. Brandon, you were talking about pine needles and how there's this belief that they make soil more acidic. You talked a little bit about this, but what do you tell people when they talk about that? Is it, hey, first of all, get a soil test to figure out if you need your soil to be more acidic, and then what should people do if they do need that?
Yeah, so great question. Typically, we want to know first what they're growing and what their intention is, and then from there, we'll determine what is the optimal soil pH. And what you need to know is, unfortunately, we're really in a tough spot to change a soil, because when you have clay soil, you need to use a ton of sulfur, because it doesn't we have a high cation exchange capacity, so it binds well. So we need extra sulfur than a soil like sand, which it leaches more easily. So basically, you want to apply elemental sulfur. It's the safest form to drop the pH. You need to do it consecutively to maintain the pH even once you get it to where it needs to be. And it can take time. The microbes that break down the sulfur and change the soil chemistry they work in warmer weather. So applying it in the fall is okay, but it's not ideal. I would say do it as soon as possible. When it's warm, they're more active. When the soil has moisture, they're more active. So as soon as you know you want to change your soil pH, you want to start applying sulfur. And then I would say do a soil test yearly to see where you're at with it. But it is an ongoing process. The parent material naturally wants to keep the soil where it wants to be. So if you stop applying sulfur after a while, it naturally will change back to what it wants to be. So here we'll have more of a 7.75. For other things, if you want to get down to a 6, you're going to have to do some work to maintain that.
Is elemental sulfur stinky?
No, okay. It isn't. It's not like it's not like bone, a fish blood bone meal, which are, you know, I haven't had issues with pests eating it. It's not something I think would, you would think, I know how sulfur would smell. It doesn't smell like rotten eggs. It's very, I don't know, it doesn't have a smell to me.
Odorless?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit pricey. So I would say use it sparingly where you really need it because, again, with clay, it's a lot. So you want to use it wisely.
And always follow labels. I can't say enough. So after, you know.
Per square foot.
Yeah, per square foot. So Extension's really good at that. But the label is the law. So no matter if it's organic or non-organic, with sulfur is organic product. So you still need to follow the label.
Right. Yeah. Because you can burn plants, you know,
easily. And like blueberries, when you need to lower the pH, you definitely want to do that ideally prior to planting, right? Because of the sensitivity of the roots and the sensitivity to the foliage. So because those types of blueberries, for example, prefer like a 4.8 to 5.2.
Acidic for here. That's a big change for here. That's a big you really have to alter your
soil.
And
as Sarah mentioned, the idea that you follow the label just because you think it's going to work more is not better.
Exactly.
And I know there are some people out there who think, oh, I'm just going to double this up. No, don't do that.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, we're not talking about Doritos here.
Exactly.
Like, yeah. Sarah, Brandon was just talking about the clay soil. I just heard this yesterday. Is this a myth? I want you to kind of debunk this or not, that you should add sand to clay soil so it drains better. What's the reality? I mean, those, from what I was reading, it doesn't really sound like that's the smart move.
So I'm going to go in with like a container gardening space or like you're amending the soil for a new planting. So what I always recommend to people, and I don't have this recipe quote in front of me, but it's also true. You always want to plant the right plant for the site, right? So you want to understand the soil, you understand the pH, you want to understand the sun exposure. So always have your plant first. Or understand the site and then choose the plant, right? And so, yes, as a horticulturalist, sometimes I find this beautiful plant and I'm like, okay, now where am I going to put it? I get it. It happens to us all, right? So back to sand. So I don't want you to create not just sand, but also people put compost material in a new hole that they have dug for their green giant arborvitae, for example. I hear that's very common one. And so they're like, I need to amend the soil, so I'm going to put compost. I'll put sand down too. And I was like, well, what you're actually doing is just in that perfect little hole that you've created, you've been digging for this ball and burlap, you know, plant. And what you're creating is that bowl, that water bowl is what it's called. So once those roots start to elongate and stretch out into native soil, what ends up happening is they're girdling around that very, made up soil composition that you've created. And a lot of times what ends up happening is the water will sit there because then it's not able to drain through that clay soil. And a lot of times we see root rot. So if you do need to amend soil for whatever reason, again, there's not one. I would not recommend this for all plants. So if you have specific questions, reach out to me. But if you're doing like an arborvitae screen, I always say not just individual holes, amend that soil and that whole space all together. That's a lot of work. I get it, right? And so, and I don't know the recipe, again, right off the top of my head, how much, but I always say use as much native soil as possible, right? And then you want to top dress. Once you've put in that plant, then top dress with good compost. I personally only use sand in container gardening to allow good drainage. I've never used it in ornamental. I have used a little bit in some vegetable gardening, but ornamental, perennial, I have personally not used any sand in this area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We do have a caller on the line. Hey, Jeffrey, thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hello. I'm concerned about my compost heap. I'm following all the rules about not putting any meat products in or any oil. I use a combination of kitchen refuse, leaves, and some soil from the garden, and I keep turning it every day to keep the oxygen level high. But my problem is I seem to be attracting flies, and when flies come, so do maggots, and it's a little revolting, actually, turning over my compost heap and seeing all these white maggots busy burrowing around. My question is that a problem, or is that just a natural feature, or could it affect somehow the quality of the compost, which would then be not useful in my garden? So I hope you'll be able to provide some information about maggots and compost.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Who wants to take that one?
I have an idea.
Okay.
Yeah, I do too, but it's fine.
Ooh, it's a contest.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah. It's an eye
well,
contest.
Well, I think to me, I want to ask his ratio of carbon and nitrogen.
So nitrogen is my big thing.
Right.
Like it needs to heat up.
And there might be too much wet material in there. Mm-hmm. There might not be enough grass and dry leaves and things. And when the ratio is incorrect, you're going to get a lot of rotting. The oxygen's going to be low. You can't get good compost shouldn't really have a smell. It should smell very earthy. And you really shouldn't have maggots and things.
Really?
It should heat up.
You should not have maggots in your compost.
And every day, it might be a little bit too excessive.
Yeah, you don't need to change. You don't need to turn it that much. Right. And you're going to have bugs in there, sure. You should have lots of worms. Maggots might occur, but that is an indicator. Maybe you have a lot of fruit in there, a lot of like vegetables.
So we're like pro worm, anti maggot. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, and just a good balance. Like you need to have enough carbon and dry materials in there to make sure. It's usually 2 to 1 or 3 to 1 the ratio of dry to wet materials.
And so Extension has a good resource on that.
Yes, we do.
And also my coworker DJ Scully, he's doing a compost giveaway coming up for all residents in Campbell County, and has a class on that. So just throwing that out as well. But nitrogen is a great source. It'd be grass clippings that haven't been treated. You can put a high nitrogen fertilizer on there. All that does is just help, quote, cook or heat up that space.
Yeah. So, Jeffrey, if you don't live in Campbell County, you should just move there, right?
Well, yeah. Wherever you are, your Extension service, I mean, I'm looking at a page from OSU Extension regarding compost. And so it's available to you, and there's so many great vetted sources that you can go and look up. And even with, I'm trying to think of the author of the book, the composting book here, right here. Ball is her last name, Michelle Ball.
Well done.
An incredible book. And boy, is she all about compost. So there's plenty of opportunities, like Sarah was saying, between classes through, whether it's an Extension class, whether it's through the Civic Garden Center, whether it's through a library where, you know, soil and water's coming in. You have those opportunities at your fingertips. Use them, but make sure they're vetted.
Okay. Well, we're going to be back with our gardening show after a short break. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today and doing some garden myth busting with our experts. My guests are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, naturalist at the Crow Nose Carol Mundy, and Kenton County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Brandon George. They're here to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We did get an email from Matt. Matt writes, does anyone have any experience doing anything with very ripe cucumbers? I've gotten lazy with my garden and have many big yellow cucumbers. I've found someone online who peels and deseeds these cucumbers, then pickles them. I'm going to try that, but I'd be happy to hear anyone's experience or suggestions. Carol, it sounds like...
I roast them.
Ooh.
I had exactly the same thing. They're big and yellow, and you're like, oh, I don't want to put this on the compost pile. I went to all that trouble. And so I do the same thing. I peel them out, break them open, basically like a squash, keep them thick, get the seeds out. Some people like to eat the seeds, but, you know, they're kind of rough by then.
Yeah, they make me burp.
Yeah, a little olive oil, a little garlic, a little balsamic vinegar. And then you just roast them at around 375 or 400, 425 until they're the texture you want. You don't want to go overboard. They'll just be mush.
Yep.
But they can be just past that crisp stage, and the flavor is so sweet. It's almost like a melon.
Oh, well, there you go, Matt. That sounds like a great suggestion. Jim asks, I can't grow rhododendrons, wondering why in Southeast Ohio I have such a hard time growing them.
Wow. I'm in the same situation. When I first moved to this area, I grew up in Pennsylvania, and we have lots of rhododendrons. It's more acidic. It just really does not favor. We're unfortunate because, you know, they don't really like heavy clay soil. And not only that, we have the wrong pH.
Winters.
The winters, it's not even that much of a winter problem because they're pretty cold hardy, especially Rhododendron Maximum, like the one in native in the Appalachian Mountains.
Yeah.
They're really tough, that and Katabiense. But it, when it comes down to it's the right soil structure and the right pH. And if you want to have rhododendrons around here, you really need to completely alter your soil. I would say you add in peat moss, make sure it's well drained. You really have to baby it, and it's not going to be an easy thing to do long term.
Sounds like a lot of work.
It is.
Okay, we have Sue Ellen on the line. Hey, Sue Ellen, thanks for calling. What is your question or comment?
Okay, it's a comment about the discussion, the preceding discussion of the Arbor Day offer of free trees.
Okay.
And I would just like to say I've experienced that. I believe that the Arbor Day Foundation has a purpose. Your donation goes to them, and they have done a lot of good work for decades of raising awareness of trees.
Sure, yeah.
Back to when I was in grade school.
Okay. I'm going to put you on hold, Sue Ellen, so our experts can respond to that. Certainly, I don't think anybody of us were trying to diss the Arbor Day Foundation. It was just a question of, will those plants grow well here? Does anybody want to comment on what Sue Ellen was saying there?
They have a lot of great resources available for professionals as well, but I was just answering the question.
Yeah, yeah.
And you make that choice whether you're going to donate to a cause and basically get a gift in return. And so the person who was calling, in my interpretation, was that they were calling to see, like you said, were they native here? Would they grow here? And that was the line of discussion. We were not trying to be disrespectful of Arbor Day Foundation. They have been around and provide really good information.
Sure, and you could donate and say no thank you to the
Correct.
Free plants because they won't grow here. So,
yeah.
Well, thanks so much, Sue Ellen. We appreciate that. Sorry if we gave anybody the wrong impression. We appreciate your calling to help us clear that up. We have Ken on the line. Hi, Ken. What is your question or comment?
I have a Cypress nucatensis about 6 years old. And after the dry spell and the summer, the needles have started turning brown, orange, and then a brown from the trunk working outwards onto the limbs. So the outside of the limbs are green, the top is green, but inside by the trunk, it's an orange-brown color, and the needles are just dead.
Hmm, okay.
If I can answer this one. So this is Alaskan weeping cedar.
Yeah.
I have this plant at home. I know it really well, and I can tell you it is pretty drought tolerant. But so what I would say is this: in the fall, pine needles do drop needles, and as they grow, what will happen is the inside of that tree will lose needles. So it might not be drought stress and might be drought stress. Around August, September, it's not uncommon for them to start losing those inner scaly needles, and so that might be the case. Obviously, it is an evergreen, and it does need winter. It does need water throughout the summer, so just check on that. But that's completely normal. Evergreens, pine trees, conifers, they lose their needles and scales, and you might be completely okay.
And for anybody who's worked at, you know, whether you're an arboretum or at a park that has these sample or specimen plants, I can't tell you how many times people would come to the visitor desk and say, your Don Redwood is dying, or your Alaskan cypresses or cedar, it's not really either one of those, but that it's dying and it's just going through that natural shedding because we all think of evergreen. I'm using my air quotes here, but they do have to release those needles and grow new ones.
Okay.
And remember, there are some deciduous evergreens. We've had a call before that I've recently cut down my bald cypress because all the needles were shedding. And sometimes you know, homeowners don't realize that there are deciduous evergreens, meaning that they drop their needles every year. Mm. And so it was not dead.
Aww.
So just be mindful of the life cycle, too.
Yeah, not dead yet, like the Monty Python movie. Thanks, Ken. Appreciate that call. We have Ashley on the line. Hi, Ashley. Thanks for calling. Do you have a question for our experts?
Hi, yes. I recently purchased a Lomi, the tabletop
composter, and I am really struggling with getting quality compost out of it. On the 14-hour compost setting, it's wet, and like the other caller said, I end up getting bugs in it. And if I do the 4-hour fast compost, it just looks like dirt sand. Is the loamy a good choice for people who want to enrich, you know, their houseplants? Or is it kind of just a little gimmicky?
Good question, Ashley.
Sarah, I don't have any experience with that one.
I've seen them advertised, and I think it uses like heat and certain microbes you have to add to it. Mm-hmm. I would say you probably have to follow the recipe like really accurately. And I mean, because I think something's going on there chemically that it's obviously kind of like cooking it to make it compost that quickly. So I don't know, but I'm not sure if there's help online. You could call the company. That might be what you do first, because I would imagine other people have probably had the same situation.
Yeah. Our producer reminds me, Ashley, that we did a composting show, and our experts on that show never recommended that. So take that for what it's worth. Sorry you're having trouble with it, but I hope you figure it out. Thanks for calling. We have Eric on the line. Hi, Eric. What is your question?
Hi. My question, I have an oak tree that's a volunteer, and I would like to put it in a more propitious spot where it gets more sun and more area to expand. It is about 10 feet high, and it has a trunk diameter of about an inch and a half, and I wondered what's the best time of year to transplant it. Should I do it now? Should I wait till October or December? And any help you can give me with that, I'd appreciate.
Thanks, Eric. Sarah, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that's a big, nice little volunteer you got
there.
I'm thinking of like this little baby, seedling. So fall is a great year, definitely with this drought-like weather, I would not move anything right now. You might want to dig up your hole, get that ready, get, you know, some good mulch ready to, of course, top dress with that. And then it's always good the first, never fertilize your first transplant or the first year after transplant, right? You don't really need to put anything in the hole. It's love and life where in your space now, you just need to put it in a new little spot. So, and you may never need to fertilize it. You know, I always say if you fertilize once, you might have to fertilize for the rest of its life, right? So native stuff, you just give it some love, some water, talk to it every now and again, and you should be fine. But yeah, Definitely the fall.
So wait till maybe more like October, are you thinking?
Yeah.
We need some good rain to make sure that
I'm hoping Mother Nature gives us that this Friday, mm-hmm. right? But we need a few more of those days, right?
Yeah, so. I agree to wait until fall. It's the heat and the drought situation is just not, it's not going to make a positive outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And get as much of that root ball as possible. That's actually a significant tree to transplant. So that might be a large task on your part. So
get some friends.
Get some friends. Shovels, you might do it in stages, you know. Get as much of the root ball as possible.
And expect transplant shock, being that it's taprooted for sure. So the two, 3 years, it might kind of just sit there, and you might be wondering why, and that might be the reason.
Yeah, kind of might give you a teenage tree pout kind of thing going on.
Yeah, that's why transplanting trees, the older they get, the slower they are to recover, you know, unlike younger trees.
Okay. Well, thanks, Eric.
All right. Thank you.
Sure. Bye. Best of luck. Bye-bye. And we have Barbara on the line. Hi, Barbara.
Hi.
What is your question?
I have a very old lilac, just the regular lilac vulgaris. It's probably 15 feet tall and wide, and it dropped almost all of its leaves. Doesn't look like blight. It's not starting with a circle. It's just the whole leaf browned and dropped. It's now re-leafing and blooming.
Hmm. And so you're wondering what the heck's going on there?
I am.
Okay. Do you have thoughts, Brandon?
Did you notice any powdery mildew symptoms?
No.
Okay.
Which, you know, it's had it before, but no, it hasn't.
Lilac borer is also a challenging, it's a pest. So it gets a lot of times in mature lilacs around the base of it. So you might look for mushy areas or sunken areas or holes. If you've seen an increase of activity of birds in the area too, that might be a sign. But you're welcome to send me a picture of this space. And of the plant, if you're in Campbell County, I could potentially set up a time to come see you. But lilacs, the old-fashioned lilacs, they have a life expectancy, and it's usually, I mean, 20, 25 years is very old. So in an urban setting, I'd say more on the 15, 20-year side. So just something to think about, too.
Hmm. Barbara, I think just from my point of view, and I don't have it in my yard, but my neighbors do. Hello, Barbara, by the way. And they're very old lilac. Same thing happened, and it was a very droughty condition. And once it got watered, once we got into the fall, the plant actually re-leafed and bloomed in the fall. Not big blooms, not a tremendous what you usually see in the spring, but I have seen that happen with some of these other shrubs. Azaleas, some of the smaller azaleas have done that, where they just kind of get confused as if another season has passed. And so they're counting it in years or seasons. Mm-hmm. And so they might get that. But I think the droughtiness may have a lot to do with it.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, because that's exactly what's happened to this. I mean, the blooms are not as big as normal, but there are quite a few of them on there.
Mm. Okay. Well, thanks, Barbara. Thanks for listening. We appreciate your call. Best of luck with your lilac.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We have another email question. This is from Jason. Jason writes, we are thinking about doing some cold frame gardening this summer. What would you suggest we try? Any tips on how to be successful?
With building it or what to plant?
This is all I got, Sarah.
I mean, that's always good for
build it now.
Yeah. I would say, at least in other countries like the UK, I think of, they use cold frames all the time, and they often do it with half-hardy annuals, things like peas, sweet peas, anything that's like you want to get a head start early on in the season, so you want it cool enough that they're not going to like bolt early vegetables. It's a great way to kind of start hardening things off and get them ahead of time, get them going, like lettuces and
tomatoes,
brassicas, anything in like the broccoli cabbage family. So things like that, things that need an early jumpstart to the season that need a prolonged cool period that we just don't have.
The venting is important, so make sure whatever you use, you have some way to vent it because it heats up.
Right, on a sunny day.
Yeah, so some people put them on top of soil. They might dig it in, like the base, whatever you choose, but make sure there's some kind of vent. A fan's always nice if there's a way to get put a fan near it to help with circulation.
Okay, and the material that it's built out of can make a big difference. The one that we have is basically a 4x8, but the boards that form the sides are probably 2 or 3 inches, and then there's a layer of that green insulation board. Mm. We've lined it so that we control what the moisture is and things aren't digging through. And then the top is actually an arch shape with a solidex like you would put on a greenhouse. And then Mr. Mundy kindly weighted that so that, because I can't reach across. Yeah. So it's I can set it to be open an inch or 4 inches or 6 inches. Mm. But it's high enough that as things do grow, you're not smashing them down.
Gotcha. Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Well, that's handcrafted right there.
It is.
No kidding.
Custom. I'm really lucky. Yeah.
We have an email from Ernest. The weather this summer has been fairly cooperative as far as rain, but when we have long stretches of no rain, what's the best way to water the lawn? I've been of the understanding that when it does not rain, it will force the grass roots deeper, which is better in the long run, so I've been told to only water once a week, but soak the lawn instead of a little bit of watering every day.
He's right. I mean, watering less frequently but deeper is the way to establish perennials and anything, really. Regards to the lawn, I mean, that might be your best course of action, but also you could just not water it too if you don't want to, because our fescues are very adapted to withstanding droughts. So they might turn brown, but as soon as rain comes back, they often will get green very quickly again. So
it's also weather dependent, not just atmospheric temperatures, it's soil temperature. And that's what I remind people. Fescue is a cool season grass. Mm-hmm. So they prefer cooler temperatures. Yes, atmospheric, but also soil temperature. And of course, there's a resource for that. So if you're trying to germinate seed or reestablish or whatever the situation is, it's all about that temperature, right, of the soil as far as atmospheric too. So water can help, but it's not going to drop temperatures to turn things to make it, I guess, long lasting, you know, green.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we will be back to finish up our gardening show after a short break. If you've got questions, now is the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're in the home stretch of our full hour of gardening. My guests are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, naturalist at the Crow Nose, Carol Mundy, and Kenton County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Brandon George. They're ready to answer your questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We started out talking about busting garden myths, and we got an email question about one of these myths. The emailer asks, coffee grounds in your garden or not? Lots of people do it. Is this a good idea? Sarah, I'll let you weigh in.
I mean, I always say this is a really tough one, right? So it is an organic product, right? And so if possible, add it to a compost bin. It can be a little tricky, just free for all, just adding it into the garden. That's a very short answer.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So maybe.
Yeah. There's okay. situations potentially.
Yeah. But maybe you should do a little more homework.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. We got an email from Ginger. Ginger emails, I have a question about my purple cone flowers. For many years, I've had very tall, light purple cone flowers with a very small, flat cone. A few years later, I planted a shorter, dark purple cone flower with a huge cone. The next year, when they came up, the very tall, light purple with small cone was shorter, medium purple, and larger cone. The shorter, dark purple, huge cone one was taller, medium pink, and smaller cone. What caused this? Was it their seeds? Was it pollinators, weather, type of soil? Does this happen very often? Because although they are still pretty, now all the plants look the same. I liked the variety. It sounds like these flowers went on a date.
I have seen where you take a native plant and then you do the cultivar of that. And the cultivar, one that comes to mind is, I don't know if you Husker's Red, are you familiar with that one, a Penstemon? Anyway, mm-hmm. It starts out this beautiful burgundy. It's a perennial. It looks great. And after a few years, it says, I'm not doing that anymore. And it goes back to its plain green color. And I think that these longer lived perennials, and coneflower being one of them, purple coneflower, is that, the genes, whatever, they're going to change over time. I think that happens a lot in these cultivars.
Yeah, so the cultivars can revert back, mm-hmm. right? And so also the natives maybe can outcompete some. I don't know. These are just thoughts, right? And then I would also say that irrigation could play a role in that.
Definitely.
Mm. Okay. Okay. We got an email from Kathy. Kathy emails, I have tomatoes planted in raised bed garden and move them every year, but unfortunately they are now getting tomato blight no matter where I plant them. I don't have any other space. I need to add dirt and compost to the existing raised bed garden. I don't want to have to empty all the soil that's there now. Do I have options? Brandon, do you have thoughts about that one? Oh, Brandon's like, my thought is that Sarah should answer.
Maybe not my favorite question.
Yeah.
Not your favorite? Okay.
Okay, lightning round. I'm going to try to keep it short and sweet. So I wouldn't empty garden soil, right? So actually the overwintering structure of either early blight or late blight, what this sounds like it could be. But again, let's get it identified first. Because sometimes blight is just a very generic term.
Yeah.
So if it is truly the pathogen for early blight or late blight, then it is going to overwinter on that host plant, so Solanaceae plant, so the tomato. So it's not in your soil unless you don't practice good sanitation mm-hmm. practices at the end of the season, then yes, it could overwinter on the foliage, right, or the stem or whatever it is. So It also is plant selection. So there are some that are resistant, but again, that's not immunity. And also pruning up. So it is a pathogen, right? And it could be splashed up, especially, both early blight, which starts on the lower limbs, moves its way up. Light blight starts at the top, moves its way down. So it's all about good airflow, light. So thinning out, which I do a few times a year, pruning up my tomato plants, which I did mine 3 times this year. And I still am getting some early blight, or I did get early blight, but I'm also also irrigating with a very low, focusing on that root zone, avoiding any splashing. That is a lot, I know, but to be honest, you're never not going to have blight.
Okay. We have an email from Dylan. Dylan writes, I have seen so few butterflies this year as opposed to last year, especially monarchs. I know populations of all sorts of invertebrates are in significant decline, but this seems like a very dramatic change in just one season. Is there anything individual gardeners can do to help support those threatened species besides simply planting host and food species and not spraying pesticides?
Can I take that one?
Sure.
I have experienced that same thing, having been in the same place for many, many, many years, and the numbers have truly dropped. And I really think that, I mean, I have a yard full of native plants, so it's there. I just don't have the numbers of butterflies. And I really feel like the number of people around me, I don't use lawn chemicals or spray, but I think near me is part of that. And so when you're in a neighborhood, you're part of that same quilt. And what they do 3 doors up may actually affect what you're doing, whether they're treating their lawn, spraying the house for bugs, spraying for whatever they think is happening in their garden. I think we all end up paying the price within that same neighborhood. Also, wherever those adults may have been feeding earlier on, and they may have collected a chemical, a toxin, picked up a bacteria, a pathogen, and now the eggs are not viable. Even though they went through the whole process, they're not viable. It's a sad thing.
I think also what I've seen in Campbell County, and I have not asked an entomologist this whatsoever, but the overall urbanization, you know, you're deforesting an area, construction is happening. So those overwintering sites, the plant material where some insects are overwintering, that space is being destroyed, right? So, I have found that. I also am blaming Mother Nature on that as well, as far as temperature, but I am not an expert on this whatsoever.
Also, yeah. I think, you know, looking at monarchs specifically and butterflies that move, there can be storms that interrupt their migration.
Exactly.
And so from year to year, it can fluctuate somewhat.
Okay. We have one more question from Tana Weingartner, our beloved colleague here. While hiking this weekend and in social media posts earlier this summer, I noticed pawpaw trees already in fruit. Mm-hmm. Climate change is the first culprit that comes to mind, but is there actually something going on with pawpaws fruiting way early this year?
I think it varies a lot from year to year. I'm not at all surprised that they're coming on. It's bad when you've planned your pawpaw festival for later in September. That seems to be the course of things, that they're happening earlier and earlier.
Okay.
And I have no pawpaws this year. The squirrels got them.
Oh, lucky
they had
squirrels.
Little baby ones, and then I was so excited, and now they're all gone.
I bet the squirrels look really cute taking them away, though.
I didn't see them.
Okay. Or you would have done something about it, maybe.
Right.
Getting back my
right.
pawpaws. We started out talking about debunking myths. Sarah, what's your advice for people when they're looking online, because you've got these questions when the extension office isn't open and you really need to know at midnight on Sunday or whatever? What's your advice for people to look online to get the right advice they need?
Right. So I sometimes I don't always have the answer, right? And so, for example, I might put best vegetable plants to grow in the fall in Kentucky. So I'm not just going to leave my search engine with just that. I'm always going to end that with either extension or university. And usually the first few resources that pop up are going to be accredited, right? And so I do this also when I am looking up an MSD sheet for a chemical, for example. You know, we all are guilty. The chemical sheet, water got on it, or you can't peel it back anymore and read it. So I literally just go on that the website and look it up right then and there. So just go to the source. Don't make it up. And when in doubt, just take pictures of things. If you're trying to identify the blight on the tomato, take a picture of the situation, close up, maybe a few around the landscape, and send it to your extension agent. And for me, I get back to you fairly quickly with the resource. But always make sure, you know, how to prune your lilac. Don't just end it with that, because you could get, you know, someone that's living in Hawaii that does it at a different time, especially when we're talking about pest management, organic or synthetic use. It doesn't matter, because it's all chemical and we want to make sure that respective. And with that being said, there are some organic products like that do control true caterpillars, which also control the monarchs and other, like the swallowtail caterpillars. So we just have to be mindful of using chemicals, again, organic or not organic.
Yeah. Brandon, what's your best advice for where, like, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I would echo what Sarah said. I also would just say, look at multiple sources, because, you know, there's just a lot of information out there. So,
yeah. Carol, when you've got questions, you probably already have all your own answers already. But
I'm that person who wakes up at 2 o'clock. Oh, I wonder if I could figure out how to.
Yeah.
And I agree with both of them. Always look at those sources, the university sources. And the other thing, I try and look at some scientific papers, and I look for the most recent research, because what might have been the way of things, the standard operating procedure 10, 20, 40 years ago, we have found out so much more today. And so go, if you're looking at scientific, a lot of research I do is through scientific journals, read the new stuff. You can use the old stuff as a foundation, but read the new stuff to make sure you're moving in the right direction.
Yeah. We did get another email from Donna. Donna emails, I've been hearing about beneficial predator insects to help with spider mites, fungus, gnats, etc. Is there anywhere in the Cincinnati area where these can be purchased?
It's usually like they send them to you.
Oh, it's a mail order kind of thing?
Yeah.
Typically.
There's a space, an entomologist actually from UK, but she has a store actually in Louisville, which I have, that's local to me, but she still ships them to us. So if you tell her your target pest that you're trying to eradicate, she will make sure that you get those predatory beneficial insects. But there are some other online resources. But again, you know, ladybugs aren't going to eat everything. So just make sure you know your target pest and you know what beneficial insect you need.
Okay. And know the source that those bugs come from.
Oh,
because
yes,
you might be creating more of a problem.
Yes.
And plus, I don't think they come trained to stay in the spot that you put them. But I think it's really important not to import something bad.
Yeah, we'll have to leave it there. I've been talking with Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Imbus, naturalist at the Crow Nose, Carol Mundy, and Kent County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Brandon George. Thank you all so much for your time today.
So fun.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. If you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.